Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with historian Carol Anderson for the hour today. Her latest book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We last left off before the break. We were getting into the civil rights period of Brown v. Board in 1954. And Carol Anderson, you wanted to continue from there.
Yes. And so here we have Brown. And Brown, the NAACP's initial framing of that was, okay, so Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal. The states immediately ran to separate. They got that, my brother would say, with a quickness. That needed no explanation. They were separating all over the place. But it was the equal part. So they didn't even implement Plessy. They couldn't get to equal. And so you had wildly disparate funding and disparate accommodations and disparate quality of schools. In Mississippi, for instance, in Amity County, African Americans were funded at about $3 per capita and white students at about $30 per capita. That's disparate funding. And so as the NAACP first goes after disparate funding and the states really can't equalize the system, there's not enough money to do that. The federal government had estimated during World War II they would take about, and this is in 2014 dollars, about $1.2 trillion to equalize the school systems in the United States. So when they can't get to that, then comes Brown. With that Brown decision, the South had already been gearing up its arsenal. And part of that arsenal was to shut down the public school systems altogether and then take public dollars. Now, they would talk about it in terms of their dollars, but African Americans paid taxes too. Take these public dollars and then provide tuition funding for all white segregated public academies, so that white students could continue their education while the public school system was shut down. This was most obvious and egregious in Prince Edward County, Virginia, where that school system was shut down for 5 years. White students continued to go through and get educated. Black students were not. And what we know with child development, that 5 years is a long time to be without schooling. You miss so much. And the way that the South just entrenched itself in terms of saying, look, as long as we can legislate, we can segregate. The Georgia Attorney General said, look, we know that a lot of the laws that we're passing are unconstitutional and that they're going to be overturned. But we're going to keep passing them. Because every time we do, it is going to take more and more time before we have to implement that U.S. Supreme Court decision. That is white rage. So here you have black children who want to get educated, who want to go to school. And the response is, we will shut down your schools. We will pass one unconstitutional law after the next to ensure that you do not get educated.
Carol Anderson, going from the civil rights movement forward, and certainly the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Economic Opportunity Act of 64, set federally some changes that were attempted to be implemented in many places and were strongly resisted by very angry white people. But the code words for affirmative action came out of that. And you very correctly talk about affirmative action as primarily just recruitment, a recruitment for jobs or recruitment for schools. And essentially that's what it was. But for most white people, it meant preference, which was illegal, still is, always has been. But affirmative action meant preference for people of color. And that just brought out more white rage than ever.
Still does.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Mickey and I deal with this in the classroom all the time. And it's the mythology around that, you know, that like there was quota systems that had to be managed. You know, the only time that ever was a quota system was there was prior proven discrimination in a court order for, you know, a certain percentage, like one out of three hires. San Francisco Fire Department, certainly Lucky Stores here in California, a number of cases like that. But those were court-ordered things. It was illegal completely to have quota systems per se. but that became part of the mythology. And certainly the war on poverty manifested itself in a variety of ways with community action agencies at a local level, and in many cases empowering local Black folks to engage in and be part of that process, challenging what had been an all-white welfare system in the country.
Yes.
And, you know, welfare, you know, the Social Security Act was for white women. And all of a sudden, there's a surge of Black families going in under AFDC, so that had to be completely changed under the Clinton administration and eliminated, literally. So all of that has this history of countermanding any of the opportunities that were emerging at that time.
Absolutely. And you see this, for instance, in, let's take the vote. Right now, there's so much effort being put in to try to reinstitute the Voting Rights Act. So we get the Voting Rights Act in 65. The only way that act came through was to say that it had to be re-upped in 5 years, reapproved in 5 years by Congress. So in 1970, so we've got the Voting Rights Act in 65. By 1970, the act is coming up again, and the Nixon administration comes out against it. And comes out against it in that very subtle, cool way. You can't say, no, I don't want these Black people to vote, because, again, this is 1970. So what they say is that the act discriminates against the South, and that the act really isn't needed. It targets the South. That is just wrong. Now, the reason it was targeting the South is because the South had done so much in terms of denying Black people access to the ballot box that it needed to be targeted. But the Voting Rights Act had enough flexibility as it went on that you had bail-ins and bailouts, so that all you had to do as a municipality or as a state or as a county was just stop discriminating. Quit trying to stop your people from voting. And you don't have to have federal oversight anymore. We understand this when we're so-called talking about criminals and parolees, right? But somehow when we have a state who 50 years after the Voting Rights Act is still trying to find ways to keep its citizens from having access to the ballot box, from having access into the say into their own government, somehow that state is the victim?
But it leads all the way up through the assault on Acorn.
Yes.
And the completely bogus nature of James O'Keefe and the attack on Acorn, and even though they were vindicated, their funding was gutted.
Acorn became the beard, as it were, the excuse to talk about rampant voter fraud.
Which wasn't rampant.
It was.
Election fraud is, but voter fraud is a different animal.
Let's be really clear here. This is some made-up stuff. It was when Greg Abbott down in Texas, who was then the attorney general, was trying to explain the rampant voter fraud in Texas before a judge, because right after Shelby County v. Holder, that horrific decision by the Supreme Court that gutted the Voting Rights Act by taking out Section 4, by seeing Section 4 was unconstitutional, Greg Abbott says, hey, we've got rampant voter fraud. The judge says, show me. And he can point to two cases where somebody tried to use somebody else's identification to vote.
That's some outbreak.
I'm telling you, that is rampant, right?
Two.
So Texas had about 10 million votes. So out of 10 million votes, he has two cases. Now, the way that Texas has set up its government-issued photo ID required to vote, though, is that in many counties, there is no DMV. There's no place to get that government-issued photo ID. Some people have to drive for about 250 miles to get a government-issued photo ID. Many of those folks are Black, brown, and poor, which means then, if you've got to drive 250 miles to get a voter ID, you're talking about having access to a range of resources that aren't readily available to you.
And people glom on to these myths, these fictions, just like Reagan and the welfare queen myth, which, again, there are so many examples of this. You get a couple other books out of this. By the way, we're speaking with Carol Anderson, and her book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. And we're running out of time, unfortunately. We're going to have you back on, but we have to get into a little bit of the so-called war on drugs here. And, you know, a recent piece in Harper's by Dan Baum. You know where I'm going with this, right?
I sure do.
John Ehrlichman, right, from the Nixon White House, basically is quoted as saying, the Nixon campaign in 68 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and black people. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. Okay, right? This is where he's going. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities, arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. And I know some are questioning Ehrlichman in that regard as to whether or not he actually said this, but boy, does that certainly fit the pattern, Carol Anderson.
It so fits the pattern. I did a piece in Salon where I'm talking about Donald Trump, and why the GOP is angry with Trump is because he has pulled back the veil of white rage in the GOP, that use of policies as a means to undermine and undercut black advancement.
He sure has.
And that here... And I use that Ehrlichman quote because what that war on drugs did was to criminalize blackness in ways that then undermined and undercut the advances of the Civil Rights Act as well as the Voting Rights Act. Today, because of the ways that the drug laws have been used, from the disparate sentencing,
the mandatory minimums, the privatization of the prison industry, Gary Webb's blockbuster story on crack cocaine CIA in LA. I mean, on and on.
On and on is that right now where we stand, according to the Sentencing Project, is we have about 2.2 million, I believe, African Americans who have been disfranchised because of felony convictions. The bulk of those are for nonviolent drug offending.
Well, that's what Michelle Alexander calls the new Jim Crow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think what's also important to see in this is that a study coming out of Duke shows that African Americans are one of the least likely racial and ethnic groups to use drugs. And another study out of the University of Washington, one of the least likely to sell drugs. So you've got the least likely being the most incarcerated.
Well, Carol Anderson, there are so many things in the book that we didn't get to and so many other historical parts of this significant narrative that you have in White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of a Racial Divide. Certainly didn't get to the 85 MOVE bombing in Philadelphia and, again, so many other things that have happened, including the rise of Black Lives Matter. But, Carol Anderson, we'd love to have you back on the program, and thank you so much for joining us on the Project Censored Show. Again, Carol Anderson, author most recently of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Carol Anderson, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
And thank you so much.
Liberated land, supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they owned by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That does it for our program today. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We give special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the U.S., from Maui to New York. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Habitualize, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burns. burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fought for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief, combine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of First 100 Days, United in Resistance. First 100 Days is a resource to support creative resistance to the Trump regime and takes place January 14th and 15th at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. There will be workshops on preparing for protests, interrupting oppression, creative protest tactics, and more, with the goal of strengthening our communities by channeling outrage into dynamic projects based on a deeper analysis of anti-colonial, anti-capitalist, anti-racist, and feminist histories. Again, that's First 100 Days, January 14th and 15th, at the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, 415 Southwest 10th Avenue, Suite 300 in Portland. More information on the event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 6 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland.